Chapter 5. Fomar Fomitch Makes Everyone Happy.
"Where have they brought me?"
Fomar articulated at last, in the voice of a man dying in a righteous cause. "Damnable humbug," Mizinchikov whispered beside me, as though he didn't see where he had been brought. "Now he will give us a fine exhibition."
"You are among us, Fomar. You are in your own circle," cried my uncle. "Don't give way. Calm yourself. And really, Fomar, you had better change your things or you will be ill. And won't you take something to restore you, eh? Just something, a little glass of something, to warm you?"
"I could drink a little Malaga," Fomar moaned, closing his eyes again.
"Malaga? I am not sure there is any," my uncle said, anxiously looking towards Praskovya Ilyinichna.
"To be sure there is," the latter answered. "There are 4 whole bottles left."
And jingling her keys, she ran to fetch the Malaga, followed by exclamations of the ladies, who were clinging to Fomar like flies round jam. On the other hand, Mr. Bachayev was indignant in the extreme.
"He wants Malaga," he grumbled, almost aloud, "and asks for a wine that no one drinks. Who drinks Malaga nowadays but rascals like him? Tchah, you confounded fellow! Oh, what am I standing here for? What am I waiting for?"
"Fomar," my uncle began, stumbling over every word, "you see now, when you are rested and are with us again, that is, I meant to say, Fomar, that I understand how accusing, so to say, the most innocent of beings—"
"Where is it, my innocence? Where?"
Fomar interrupted, as though he were feverish and in delirium.
"Where are my golden days? Where art thou, my golden childhood, when innocent and lovely I ran about the fields chasing the spring butterflies? Oh, where are those days? Give me back my innocence! Give it me back!"
And Fomar, flinging wide his arms, turned to each one of us in succession, as though his innocence were in somebody's pocket. Bachayev was ready to explode with wrath.
"Oh, so that's what he wants," he muttered in a fury. "Give him his innocence. Does he want to kiss it, or what? Most likely he was as great a villain when he was a boy as he is now. I'll take my oath he was."
"Fomar," my uncle was beginning again.
Where are they, those days when I still had faith in love and loved mankind?" cried Fomar. "When I embraced man and wept upon his bosom. Oh, but now where am I? Where am I?"
"You are with us, Fomar. Calm yourself," cried my uncle. "This is what I wanted to say to you, Fomar."
"You might at last keep silent now,"
hissed Miss Perepolitsin, with a spiteful gleam in her viperish eyes.
"Where am I?" Fomar went on. "Who are about me? They are bulls and buffaloes turning their horns against me. Life, what art thou? If one lives, one is dishonoured, disgraced, humbled, crushed. And when the earth is scattered on one's coffin, only then men will remember one and pile a monument on one's poor bones."
"Holy saints, he is talking about monuments," whispered Yezhevikin, clasping his hands.
"Oh, do not put up a monument to me," cried Fomar. "Do not! I don't need monuments. Raise up a monument to me in your hearts. I want nothing more, nothing more."
"Fomar," my uncle interposed, "enough, calm yourself. There is no need to talk about monuments. Only listen. You see, Fomar, I understand that you were perhaps, so to say, inspired with righteous fervour when you reproached me, but you were carried away, Fomar, beyond the limit of righteousness. I assure you, you were mistaken, Fomar.
And will you give over? Hissed Miss Perepolitzin again. Do you want to murder the poor man because he is in your hands?
After Miss Perepolitzin, Madame la Générale made a stir, and all her suite followed her example. They all waved their hands at my uncle to stop him. "Anna Nilovna, be silent yourself. I know what I am saying," my uncle answered firmly. "This is a sacred matter, a question of honour and justice. Fomar, you are a sensible man. You must at once ask the forgiveness of the virtuous young lady whom you have insulted."
"What young lady? What young lady have I insulted?"
Fomar articulated in amazement, staring round at everyone as though he had entirely forgotten everything that had happened and did not know what was the matter.
"Yes, Fomar, and if now of your own accord you frankly acknowledge you have done wrong, I swear, Fomar, I will fall at your feet, and then—"
"Whom have I insulted?"
wailed Fomar.
"What young lady? Where is she? Where is the young lady? Recall to me something about the young lady."
At that instant, Nastenka, confused and frightened, went up to Yegor Ilyich and pulled him by the sleeve.
"No, Yegor Ilyich, leave him alone. There is no need of an apology. What is the object of it all?" she said in an imploring voice. "Give it up."
"Ah, now I begin to remember," cried Fomar. "My God, I understand. Oh, help me to remember,"
he implored, apparently in great excitement.
"Tell me, is it true that I was turned out of this house like the mangiest of curs? Is it true that I was struck by lightning? Is it true that I was kicked down the steps? Is it true? Is it true?"
The weeping and wailing of the fair sex were the most eloquent reply to Fomar Fomitch.
"Yes, yes," he repeated. "I remember. I remember now that after the lightning and my fall, I was running here, pursued by the thunder, to do my duty and then vanish forever. Raise me up. Weak as I may be now, I must do my duty."
He was at once helped up from his chair. Fomar stood in the attitude of an orator and stretched out his hands.
"Colonel," he cried, "now I have quite recovered. The thunder has not extinguished my intellectual capacities. It has left, it is true, a deafness in my right ear, due perhaps not so much to the thunder as to my fall down the steps, but what of that? And what does anyone care about Fomar's right ear?"
Fomar threw such a wealth of mournful irony into these last words, and accompanied them with such a pathetic smile, that the groans of the deeply moved ladies resounded again. They all looked with reproach, and some also with fury, at my uncle, who was beginning to be crushed by so unanimous an expression of public opinion. Mizinchikov, with a curse, walked away to the window. Bachayev kept prodding me more and more violently with his elbow. He could hardly stand still.
"Now listen to my whole confession," yelled Fomar, turning upon all a proud and determined gaze, "and at the same time decide the fate of poor Opiskin. Yegor Ilyich, for a long time past I have been watching over you, watching over you with a tremor at my heart, and I have seen everything, everything, while you were not suspecting that I was watching over you. Colonel, perhaps I was mistaken, but I knew your egotism, your boundless vanity, your phenomenal sensuality, and who would blame me for trembling for the honour of an innocent young person?
Fomer, you need not enlarge on it, Fomer, cried my uncle, looking uneasily at Nastenka's suffering face.
What troubled me was not so much the innocence and trustfulness of the person in question as her inexperience,
Fomer went on, as though he had not heard my uncle's warning.
I saw that a tender feeling was blossoming in her heart, like a rose in spring, and I could not help recalling Petrarch's saying, innocence is often but a hair's breadth from ruin. I sighed, I groaned, and though I was ready to shed the last drop of my blood to safeguard that pure pearl of maidenhood, who could answer to me for you, Yegor Ilyich? I know the unbridled violence of your passions, and knowing that you are ready to sacrifice everything for their momentary gratification, I was plunged in the depths of alarm and apprehension for the fate of the noblest of girls.
Fomer, could you really imagine such a thing? Cried my uncle.
With a shudder at my heart, I watched over you. And if you want to know what I have been suffering, go to Shakespeare. In his Hamlet, he describes the state of my soul. I became suspicious and terrible. In my anxiety, in indignation, I saw everything in the blackest colour, and that not the black colour sung of in the well-known song, I can assure you. That was the cause of the desire you saw in me to remove her far away from this house. I wanted to save her. That was why you have seen me of late irritable and bitter against the whole human race. Oh, who will reconcile me with humanity? I feel that I was perhaps over-exacting and unjust to your guests, to your nephew, to Mr. Bachiev, when I expected from him a knowledge of astronomy. But who will blame me for my state of mind at the time? Going to Shakespeare again, I may say that the future looked to my imagination like a gloomy gulf of unfathomed depth, with a crocodile lying at the bottom. I felt that it was my duty to prevent disaster, that I was destined, appointed for that purpose, and what happened? You did not understand the generous impulse of my heart, and have been repaying me all this time with anger, with ingratitude, with jeers, with slights.
Fomer, if that is so, of course, I feel,
cried my uncle in extreme agitation.
If you really do feel it, Colonel, be so kind as to listen and not interrupt me. I will continue. My whole fault lay in the fact, therefore, that I was too much troubled over the fate and happiness of this child, for compared with you, she is a child. It was the truest love for humanity that turned me all this time into a fiend of wrath and suspicion. I was ready to fall on people and tear them to pieces. And you know, Yegor Ilyich, all your actions, as though of design, made me more suspicious every hour, and confirmed my fears. You know, Yegor Ilyich, when you showered your gold upon me yesterday to drive me from you, I thought, he is driving away in my person his conscience, so as more easily to perpetrate this wickedness.
Fomer, can you have thought that yesterday? My uncle cried out with horror. Merciful heavens, and I hadn't the faintest suspicion.
Heaven itself inspired those suspicions, Fomer went on. And judge for yourself. What could I suppose when chance led me that very evening to that fatal seat in the garden? What were my feelings at that moment? Oh, my God, when I saw with my own eyes that all my suspicions were justified in the most flagrant manner. but I still had one hope left. A faint one, indeed, but still it was a hope, and this morning you shattered it into dust and ashes. You sent me your letter. You alleged your intention to marry. You besought me not to make it public. But why, I wondered, why did he write now, after I had found him out, and not before? Why did he not run to me before, happy and comely, for love adorns the countenance? Why did he not fly to my embrace? Why did he not weep upon my bosom tears of infinite bliss and tell me all about it, all about it? Or am I a crocodile who would have devoured you instead of giving you good advice? Or am I some loathsome beetle who would only have bitten you and not assisted your happiness? Am I his friend, or the most repulsive of insects? That was the question I asked myself this morning. With what object, I asked myself, with what object did he invite his nephew from Petersburg and try to betroth him to this girl, if not to deceive us and his frivolous nephew, and meanwhile, in secret, to persist in his criminal designs? Yes, Colonel, if anyone confirmed in me the thought that your mutual love was criminal, it was you, yourself, and you only. What is more, you have behaved like a criminal to this young girl. For through your tactlessness and selfish mistrustfulness, you have exposed her, a modest and high-principled girl, to slander and odious suspicions.
My uncle stood silent with bowed head. Foma's eloquence was evidently getting the better of his convictions, and he was beginning to regard himself as a complete criminal. Madame la Générale and her followers were listening to Foma in awe-struck silence, while Miss Perepolitsyn looked with spiteful triumph at poor Nastenka.
"Overwhelmed, nervously exhausted, and shattered," Foma went on, "I locked myself in this morning and prayed, and the Lord showed me the right path. At last I decided, for the last time and publicly, to put you to the test. I may have gone about it with too much fervour, I may have given way too much to my indignation, but for my well-meaning effort, you flung me out of the window. As I fell out of the window, I thought to myself, this is how virtue is rewarded all the world over. Then I struck the earth, and I scarcely remember what happened to me afterwards."
Shrieks and groans interrupted Foma Fomitch at this tragic recollection. Madame la Générale made a dash at him with a bottle of Malaga in her hand, which she had just snatched from Praskovya Ilyinichna, but Foma majestically waved aside the hand and the Malaga and Madame la Générale herself.
"Let me alone," he shouted. "I must finish. What happened after my fall, I don't know. I know one thing only, that now, wet through and on the verge of fever, I am standing here to secure your mutual happiness. Colonel, from many signs which I do not wish now to particularize, I am convinced at last that your love was pure and even exalted, though at the same time criminally distrustful. Beaten, humiliated, suspected of insulting a young lady in defence of whose honour I am ready like a medieval knight to shed the last drop of my blood, I have made up my mind to show you how Foma Opiskin revenges an injury. Give me your hand, Colonel."
"With pleasure, Foma," cried my uncle. "And since you have now fully cleared the honour of this young lady from every aspersion, why, of course, here is my hand, Foma, together with my regrets."
and my uncle gave him his hand warmly, not yet suspecting what was to come of it.
"Give me your hand, too,"
went on Foma in a faint voice, parting the crowd of ladies who were pressing round him and appealing to Nastenka. Nastenka was taken aback and confused. She looked timidly at Foma.
"Approach, approach, my sweet child. It is essential for your happiness,"
Foma added caressingly, still holding my uncle's hand in his. "What's he up to now?" said Mizinchikov. Nastenka, frightened and trembling, went slowly up to Foma and timidly held out her hand. Foma took her hand and put it in my uncle's.
"I join your hands and bless you,"
he pronounced in the most solemn voice.
"And if the blessing of a poor sorrow-stricken sufferer may avail you, be happy. This is how Foma Opiskin takes his revenge. Hurrah!"
The amazement of everyone was immense. The conclusion was so unexpected that everyone was struck dumb. Madame la Générale stood rooted to the spot, with her mouth open and the bottle of Malaga in her hand. Miss Perepalitsin turned pale and trembled with fury. The lady companions clasped their hands and sat petrified in their seats. My uncle trembled and tried to say something, but could not. Nastya turned deathly pale and timidly murmured that it could not be. But it was too late. Batcheyev was the first, we must do him that credit, to second Fomar's hurrah. I followed suit, and after me, Sashenka shouted at the top of her ringing voice as she flew to embrace her father. Then Ilyusha joined in, then Yezhevikin, and last of all, Mizinchikov.
"Hurrah!" Foma cried once more. "Hurrah! And on your knees, children of my heart, on your knees before the tenderest of mothers, ask her blessing, and if need be, I will kneel before her by your side."
My uncle and Nastya, not looking at each other and seeming not to understand what was being done to them, fell on their knees before Madame la Générale. The whole company flocked round them. But the old lady seemed to be stupefied, not knowing what to do. Foma came to the rescue at this juncture, too. He plumped down himself before his patroness. This at once dispelled all her hesitation. Dissolving into tears, she said at last that she consented. My uncle jumped up and clasped Foma in his arms.
"Foma! Foma!"
he began, but his voice broke and he could not go on.
"Champagne!" bawled Mr. Batcheyev. "Hurrah!"
"No, sir, not champagne,"
Miss Perepalitsin caught him up. She had by now recovered herself and realized the position and at the same time its consequences.
"Put up a candle to God, pray to the holy image, and bless with the holy image, as is done by all godly people."
At once all flew to carry out the sage suggestion. A fearful bustle followed. They had to light the candle. Mr. Batcheyev drew up a chair and got up on it to put the candle before the holy image, but immediately broke the chair and came down heavily on the floor, still on his feet, however. Not in the least irritated by this, he at once respectfully made way for Miss Perepalitsin. The slender Miss Perepalitsin had done the job in a flash. The candle was lighted. The nun and the lady companions began crossing themselves and bowing down to the ground. They took down the image of the Saviour and carried it to Madame la Générale. My uncle and Nastya went down on their knees again, and the ceremony was carried out, under the pious instructions of Miss Perepalitsin, who was saying every minute,
Bow down to her feet. Kiss the image. Kiss your mamma's hand.
Mr. Batcheyev thought himself bound to kiss the image after the betrothed couple, and at the same time he kissed the hand of Madame la Générale.
"Hurrah!" he shouted again. "Come, now we will have some champagne."
Everyone, however, was delighted. Madame la Générale was weeping, but it was now with tears of joy. Foma's blessing had at once made the union sanctified and suitable, and what mattered most to her was that Foma Fomitch had distinguished himself, and that now he would remain with her forever. All the lady companions, in appearance at least, shared the general satisfaction. My uncle at one moment was on his knees, kissing his mother's hands, at the next was flying to embrace me, Batcheyev, Mizinchikov, and Yezhevikin. Ilyusha he almost smothered in his embraces. Sasha ran to hug and kiss Nastenka. Praskovya Ilyinichna dissolved into tears. Batcheyev, noticing this, went up to kiss her hand. Poor old Yezhevikin was completely overcome. He was weeping in a corner and was wiping his eyes with the same Czech handkerchief. In another corner, Gavrila was whimpering and gazing reverently at Foma Fomitch, and Falale was sobbing loudly and going up to each of the company in turn, kissing his hand. All were overwhelmed with feeling. No one yet had begun to talk or explain things. It seemed as though everything had been said. Nothing was heard but joyful exclamations. No one understood yet how all this had been so quickly arranged. They knew one thing only, that it had all been arranged by Foma Fomitch, and that this was a solid fact which could not be changed. But not 5 minutes had passed after the general rejoicing, when suddenly Tatiana Ivanovna made her appearance among us. In what way, by what intuition, could she, sitting in her own room upstairs, have so quickly divined love and marriage below? She fluttered in with a radiant face, with tears of joy in her eyes, in a fascinating and elegant get-up — she had had time to change her dress before coming down — and flew straight to embrace Nastenka with loud exclamations.
"Nastenka, Nastenka, you loved him, and I did not know!" she cried. "Goodness, they loved each other! They suffered in silence! They have been persecuted! What a romance! Nastya, darling, tell me the whole truth. Do you really love this crazy fellow?"
By way of reply, Nastya hugged and kissed her.
"My goodness, what a fascinating romance!"
And Tatiana Ivanovna clapped her hands in delight.
"Nastya, listen, my angel. All these men, all, everyone, are ungrateful wretches, monsters, and not worthy of our love. But perhaps he is the best of them. Come to me, you crazy fellow!" she cried, addressing my uncle and clutching him by the arm. "Are you really in love? Are you really capable of loving? Look at me. I want to look into your eyes. I want to see whether those eyes are lying or not. Oh, no. No, they are not lying. There is the light of love in them. Oh, how happy I am. Nastenka, my dear, you are not rich. I shall make you a present of 30,000 rubles. Take it, for God's sake. I don't want it. I don't want it. I shall have plenty left. No, 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 no," she cried, waving her hand as she saw Nastenka was meaning to refuse. "Don't you speak, Yegor Ilyich. It is not your affair. No, Nastya, I had made up my mind already to give you the money. I had been wanting to make you a present for a long time, and was only waiting for you to be in love. I shall see your happiness. You will wound me if you don't take it. I shall cry, Nastya. No, 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 and no."
Tatiana Ivanovna was so overjoyed that, for the moment at least, it was impossible. It would have been a pity, indeed, to cross her. They could not bring themselves to do it, but put it off.
She flew to kiss Madame la Générale, Miss Perepolitsyn, and all of us. Mr. Batsheyev squeezed his way up to her very respectfully and asked to kiss her hand.
"My dear good girl, forgive an old fool like me for what happened this morning. I didn't know what a heart of gold you had."
"Crazy fellow, I know you," Tatiana Ivanovna lisped with gleeful playfulness. She gave Mr. Batsheyev a flick on the nose with her glove, and swishing against him with her gorgeous skirts, fluttered away like a zephyr. The fat man stepped aside respectfully.
"A very worthy young lady," he said with feeling. "They have stuck a nose onto the German, you know,"
he whispered to me confidentially, looking at me joyfully. "What nose? What German?" I asked in surprise.
"Why, the one I ordered. The German kissing his lady's hand while she is wiping away a tear with her handkerchief. Only yesterday my Yevdokem mended it. And when we came back from our expedition this morning, I sent a man on horseback to fetch it. They will soon be bringing it, a superb thing."
"Foma," cried my uncle in a frenzy of delight, "it is you who have made our happiness. How can I reward you?"
"No how, Colonel," replied Foma with a sanctimonious air. "Continue to pay no attention to me, and be happy without Foma."
He was evidently piqued. In the general rejoicing, he seemed, as it were, forgotten. "It is all due to our joy, Foma," cried my uncle. "I don't know whether I'm on my head or my feet. Listen, Foma, I have insulted you. My whole blood is not enough to atone for my wrong to you, and that is why I say nothing and do not even beg your pardon. But if ever you have need of my head, my life, if you ever want someone to throw himself over a precipice for your sake, call upon me, and you shall see. I will say nothing more, Foma." And my uncle waved his hand, fully recognizing the impossibility of adding anything that could more strongly express his feeling. He only gazed at Foma with grateful eyes full of tears.
"See what an angel he is,"
Miss Perepolitsyn piped in her turn in adulation of Foma.
"Yes, yes," Sashenka put in. "I did not know you were such a good man, Foma Fomitch, and I was disrespectful to you. But forgive me, Foma Fomitch, and you may be sure I will love you with all my heart. If you knew how much I respect you now."
"Yes, Foma," Batsheyev chimed in. "Forgive an old fool like me, too. I didn't know you. I didn't know you. You are not merely a learned man, Foma, but also simply a hero. My whole house is at your service. But there, the best of all would be if you would come to me the day after tomorrow, old man, with Madame la Générale, too, and the betrothed couple, the whole company, in fact. And we will have a dinner, I tell you. I won't praise it beforehand, but one thing I can say, you will find everything you want, unless it is bird's milk. I give you my word of honour."
In the midst of these demonstrations, Nastenka, too, went up to Foma Fomitch, and without further words, warmly embraced him and kissed him.
"Foma Fomitch," she said, "you have been a true friend to us. You have done so much for us that I don't know how to repay you for it all. But I only know that I will be for you a most tender and respectful sister."
She could say no more. She was choked by tears. Foma kissed her on the head and grew tearful.
"My children, the children of my heart," he said, "live and prosper. and in moments of happiness think sometimes of the poor exile. For myself, I will only say that misfortune is perhaps the mother of virtue. That, I believe, is said by Gogol, a frivolous writer, but from whom one may sometimes glean fruitful thoughts. Exile is a misfortune. I shall wander like a pilgrim, with my staff over the face of the earth, and who knows, perchance my troubles will make me more righteous yet. That thought is the one consolation left me.
But where are you going, Foma?
My uncle asked in alarm. All were startled and pressed round Foma.
Why, do you suppose I can remain in your house after your behaviour this morning?
Foma inquired with extraordinary dignity. But he was not allowed to finish. Outcries from all the company smothered his voice. They made him sit down in an easy chair. They besought him. They shed tears over him. And I don't know what they didn't do. Of course, he hadn't the faintest intention of leaving this house, just as he had not earlier that morning, nor the day before, nor on the occasion when he had taken to digging in the garden. He knew now that they would reverently detain him, would clutch at him, especially since he had made them all happy, since they all had faith in him again, and were ready to carry him on their shoulders and to consider it an honour and a happiness to do so. But most likely, his cowardly return, when he was frightened by the storm, was rankling in his mind, and egging him on to play the hero in some way. And above all, there was such a temptation to give himself airs, the opportunity of talking, of using line phrases and laying it on thick, of blowing his own trumpet, was too good for any possibility of resisting the temptation. He did not resist it. He tore himself out of the grasp of those who held him. He asked for his staff, besought them to let him have his freedom, to let him wander out into the wide, wide world, declared that in that house he had been dishonoured, beaten, that he had only come back to make everyone happy, and he asked, could he remain in this house of ingratitude and eat soup, sustaining, perhaps, but seasoned with blows? At last he left off struggling. He was reseated in his chair, but his eloquence was not arrested.
"Have I not been insulted here?"
he cried.
"Have I not been taunted? Haven't you yourself, Colonel, have you not every hour pointed the finger of scorn and made the long nose of derision at me, like the ignorant children of the working class in the streets of the town? Yes, Colonel, I insist on that comparison, because if you have not done so physically, it has yet been a moral long nose. And in some cases a moral long nose is more insulting than a physical one. I say nothing of blows."
"Foma, Foma," cried my uncle, "do not crush me with these recollections. I have told you already that all my blood is not enough to wash out the insults. Be magnanimous, forgive, forget, and remain to contemplate our happiness. Your work, Foma."
"I want to love my fellow man, to love him," cried Foma. "And they won't give me him. They forbid me to love him. They take him from me. Give me my fellow man, that I may love him. Oh, where is that fellow man? Where is he hidden? Like Diogenes with his candle, I have been looking for him all my life and cannot find him. And I can love no one. To this day I cannot find the man. Woe to him who has made me a hater of mankind. I cry, give me my fellow man, that I may love him, and they thrust Phalalay upon me. Am I to love Fallalay? Do I want to love Fallalay? Could I love Fallalay, even if I wanted to? No. Why not? Because he is Fallalay. Why do not I love humanity? Because all on earth are Fallalays or like Fallalay. I don't want Fallalay. I hate Fallalay. I spit on Fallalay. I trample Fallalay under my feet. And if I had to choose, I would rather love Asmodeus than Fallalay. Come here. Come here, my everlasting torment. Come here, he cried, suddenly addressing Fallalay, who was in the most innocent way standing on tiptoe, looking over the crowd that was surrounding Foma Fomitch. Come here. I will show you, Colonel, cried Foma, drawing towards him Fallalay, who was almost unconscious with terror. I will show you the truth of my words about the everlasting long nose and finger of scorn. Tell me, Fallalay, and tell the truth. What did you dream about last night? Come, Colonel, you will see your handiwork. Come, Fallalay, tell us.
The poor boy, shaking with terror, turned despairing eyes about him, looking for someone to rescue him. But everyone was in a tremor, waiting for his answer.
Come, Fallalay, I'm waiting.
Instead of answering, Fallalay screwed up his face, opened his mouth wide, and began bellowing like a calf.
Colonel, do you see this stubbornness? Do you mean to tell me it's natural? For the last time I ask you, Fallalay, tell me, what did you dream of last night?
Of?
Say you dreamed of me, said Bachayev. Of your virtue, sir,
Yezhevikin prompted in his other ear. Fallalay merely looked about him.
Of a white bull,
he roared at last, and burst into scalding tears. Everyone groaned. But Foma Fomitch was in a paroxysm of extraordinary magnanimity.
Anyway, I see your sincerity, Fallalay, he said. A sincerity I do not observe in others. God bless you. If you are purposely mocking at me with that dream at the instigation of others, God will repay you and those others. If not, I respect your truthfulness. For even in the lowest of creatures like you, it is my habit to discern the image and semblance of God. I forgive you, Fallalay. Embrace me, my children. I will remain with you.
He will remain, they all cried in delight.
I will remain, and I will forgive. Colonel, reward Fallalay with some sugar. Do not let him cry on such a day of happiness for all.
I need hardly say that such magnanimity was thought astounding. To take so much thought at such a moment, and for whom? For Fallalay. My uncle flew to carry out his instruction in regard to the sugar. Immediately a silver sugar basin, I don't know where it came from, appeared in the hands of Praskovya Ilyinichna. My uncle was about to take out two pieces with a trembling hand, then three. Then he dropped them at last, seeing he was incapable of doing anything from excitement.
"Ah!" he cried. "For a day like this, hold out your coat, Fallalay."
And he poured into his coat all the contents of the sugar basin.
"That's for your truthfulness," he said, by way of edification.
"Mr. Kowovkin,"
Vido Pliasov announced, suddenly appearing in the doorway. A slight flutter of consternation followed. Kurovkin's visit was obviously ill-timed.
They all looked inquiringly at my uncle.
"Korovkin!" cried my uncle in some embarrassment. "Of course, I am delighted," he added, glancing timidly towards Foma. "But really I don't know whether to ask him in at such a moment. What do you think, Foma?"
"Oh, yes, why not?" said Foma amicably. "Invite Korovkin, too. Let him, too, share in the general rejoicing."
In short, Foma Fomitch was in an angelic frame of mind.
"I most respectfully make bold to inform you," observed Vido Plyasov, "that the gentleman is not quite himself." "Not quite himself? How? What nonsense are you talking?" cried my uncle.
"It is so, indeed. He is not quite in a sober condition."
But before my uncle had time to open his mouth, flush red, and show his alarm and extreme embarrassment, the mystery was explained. Korovkin appeared in the doorway, pushed Vido Plyasov aside, and confronted the astonished company. He was a short, thick-set gentleman of 40, with dark hair touched with grey and closely cropped, with a round purple face and little bloodshot eyes, wearing a high horsehair cravat fastened at the back with a buckle, an extraordinarily threadbare swallowtail coat covered with fluff and hay and disclosing a bad rent under the arm, and unspeakable trousers, and carrying an incredibly greasy cap, which he was holding out at arm's length. This gentleman was completely drunk. Advancing into the middle of the room, he stood still, staggering, nodding his head as though he were pecking at something with his nose in drunken hesitation. Then he slowly grinned from ear to ear.
"Excuse me, ladies and gentlemen," he began.
Here he gave a tug at his collar.
"Gorham."
Madame la Générale immediately assumed an air of offended dignity. Foma, sitting in his easy chair, ironically looked the eccentric visitor up and down. Batcheyev stared at him in perplexity, through which some sympathy was, however, apparent. My uncle's embarrassment was incredible. He was deeply distressed on Korovkin's account.
"Korovkin," he began, "listen."
"Attendez,"
Korovkin interrupted him.
"Let me introduce myself. A child of nature. But what do I see? There are ladies here. Why didn't you tell me, rascal, that you had ladies here?"
he added with a roguish smile.
"Never mind. Don't be shy. Let us be presented to the fair sex. Charming ladies,"
he began, articulating with difficulty and stumbling over every word,
"you see a luckless mortal who—" and so on. "The rest must remain unsaid. Musicians, a polka."
"Wouldn't you like a nap?" asked Mizinchikov, quietly going up to Korovkin.
"A nap? You say that to insult me?"
"Not at all. You know a little sleep is a good thing after a journey."
"Never,"
Korovkin answered with indignation.
"Do you think I am drunk?" "Not a bit. But where do they sleep here?"
"Come along, I'll take you at once."
"Where? In the coach house?" "No, my lad, you won't take me in. I have spent a night there already." "Lead the way, though. Why not go along with a good fellow? I don't want a pillow. A military man does not want a pillow. But you produce a sofa for me, old man. A sofa. And, I say,
he added, stopping,
I see you are a jolly fellow. Produce something else for me. You know, a bit of the rummy, enough to drown and lily in, only enough for that, and only one little glass, I mean.
Very well, very well, answered Mizintikov.
Very well. But you wait a bit, I must say goodbye. Adieu, madame et mademoiselle. You have, so to speak, smitten... Yeah, but there, never mind. We will talk about that afterwards. Only do wake me when it begins, or even 5 minutes before it begins. Don't begin without me, as you hear. Don't begin.
And the merry gentleman vanished behind Mizintikov. Everyone was silent. The company had not got over their astonishment. At last Foma, without a word, began noiselessly chuckling. His laughter grew into a guffaw. Seeing that, Madame la Générale, too, was amused, though the expression of insulted dignity still remained on her face. Irrepressible laughter arose on all sides. My uncle stood as though paralysed, flushing almost to tears, and was for some time incapable of uttering a word.
"Merciful heavens!" he brought out at last. "Who could have known this? But you know, it might happen to anyone. Foma, I assure you that he is a most straightforward, honourable man, and an extremely well-read man, too, Foma. You will see."
"I do see! I do see!" cried Foma, shaking with laughter. "Extraordinarily well-read. Well-read is just the word."
"How can he talk about railways?"
Yezhevikin observed in an undertone.
"Foma,"
my uncle was beginning, but the laughter of all the company drowned his words. Foma Fomitch was simply in fits, and, looking at him, my uncle began laughing too.
"Well, what does it matter?"
he said enthusiastically.
"You are magnanimous, Foma. You have a great heart. You have made me happy. You forgive Korovkin, too."
Nastenka was the only one who did not laugh. She looked with eyes full of love at her future husband, and looked as though she would say,
"How splendid! How kind you are! The most generous of men, and how I love you!"